Hey, how's it going, guys? It's already that time again. Time for the show. The Scott Horton Show. I'm him. What the? All right. I got to write up a blog entry, man. I know. I'm supposed to do this before the show, not at the start of the show. But, you know, I sort of kind of sloppily can kill two birds with one stone this way. If I would only type fast and speak well while I'm typing fast. Yeah. Okay, good deal. All right. Well, so here's how that goes. Today's show, Shane Bauer and Patrick Coburn. Nah, you know, that sounded a lot more like I was talking while I was typing than I was just talking and typing, I admit. Well, anyway, that's going on now on the show. What I need is for more of my guests to also answer my emails, in which case I could have even more interviews for you on the show today, which I know would make you very happy. All right, cool. So, yes, Coburn says that he is in the middle of writing a 3,000-word piece that is due right around the time he's going to be on the show. So, that should be great. Yesterday, of course, I interviewed Patrick's brother, Andrew, all about the military-industrial complex and the fight over the A-10 and its future. It's an interesting story, that A-10 story. You know, if you're interested in stuff. And anyway, so now his brother Patrick, the war reporter, he'll be back on the show today to talk about the war. And so, boy, I better check during the break and make sure. Last thing I read by him was about the Turks' relationship with the different Kurdish factions. So I'll be asking questions about that, the PKK and etc. So, yeah, the ISIS war. If you want to know why, I've been so good on the ISIS war since before June and the retaking of Mosul by al-Qaeda in Iraq. And the declaration of the caliphate and all that. It's mostly because I interview Patrick Coburn all the time, as often as I can. And I know I probably annoy the hell out of him now. I email him just about every day. But he's also very generous with his time, too, so I don't know. And you can go back and listen to my interviews with him since, I don't know when I really started interviewing him. Probably 2008 or 9 or something. But, you know, certainly this whole time since the Arab Spring we've had in 2011, we've had Patrick Coburn's take. Well, hell, no, not rewind, man. The entire... all through 2007 and 2008, I was interviewing him all around, all about the surge, and the civil war in Iraq and the end of that war and how Maliki, pushed Bush out in 2008 and, yeah, all of this. And then certainly again, then since the Arab Spring, he's covered the Libya war for us, the civil war in Syria, and has predicted all along that yes, the civil war in Syria is already re-energizing the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq, is already blowing back into Iraq and is leading to these problems. So, and then as I was mentioning, I think on the show yesterday, more than a year ago, year and a half ago, right around, say a year and 2 months, or maybe a year and a month before the declaration of the caliphate, really just not long after they renamed, or Baghdadi attempted to rename al-Nusra the Islamic State, and then they broke apart. Nusra said, no, we're still Nusra, and you're the Islamic State, and all this side issue. But right around then, Iraqi army, meaning Shiite militia guys that George W. Bush had dressed up in American fatigues, they were withdrawing from their posts up in the Sunni Triangle, up in near Mosul especially. They were withdrawing because it's not their territory and they didn't have the support to be there. And he explained how the Iraqi army was a giant joke and how every division is three times its size on paper because it's all just about kickbacks. It's like a big Ponzi scheme, basically. You know, you pay money to join, and then hopefully you get more money before the whole thing falls apart. That was George Bush's Iraqi army there. And so, you know, that was why I was able to write correctly in April of 2013, a year and 2-3 months before the declaration of the caliphate, that, look, it's the rise of the caliphate, the one that never existed, the one that George Bush pretended he was fighting that wasn't there, the one that Osama bin Laden always wanted. Their fantasy is now becoming true. And one, because George Bush gave all of Western and Northwestern Iraq to Sunni Mujahideen to thrive in for years on end, what, 8 years? But then Obama came and took their side in Libya and in Syria. And so this is what re-energized them, in Coburn's words, and blew back into Iraq. Anyway, so he's going to be on the show. And speaking of the Libya war, did you know that the Canada shooter's father fought in the Mujahideen on Obama's side in Libya? He was a good Sunni-based insurgent. Was he from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group? Or was he from Ansar al-Sharia? I don't think we know yet. But, yep, that's whose side Obama took in that war, as the father of the guy who, now apparently, they wouldn't let him leave the country. He said, I want to go to Libya to be an idiot and get shot. And they wouldn't let him leave. So he killed the soldier and attacked the parliament. They should have let him leave. They should have taken his passport after they got him out of Canada. What the hell? And you know, if you read about this, the war, the Mujahideen war in Syria, I don't know about Libya, but probably the same difference there. You read about this fighting, the Western romantics who come to join up in this thing are the most expendable of all. They don't even speak Arabic, most of them, just a little bit. And they're just there for the adventure. They don't know anything about Islam. They don't know anything about where they are or what the culture is or whatever. And so, here, strap on this suicide belt and drive this truck that way, they're told. And that's about the end of their battlefield experience. So, by all means, let them go. I mean, seriously, what is this, like the Darwin Awards? You want to go and take the side of bin Ladenites in Syria? Have fun getting killed, idiot. Go ahead and leave. Or certainly, if you're going to keep them here, strip them of their passports, and refuse to let them leave North America, well, then at least put an agent on them. Since you know how far they're willing to go already. These are the federal police sent to protect us, right? Oh, no, this guy, he's a good guy. His father was good Al-Qaeda in the Libya war in 2011. Oh, okay. Don't worry about him, I guess, huh, guys? I'm making that up. I'm not saying that's in the reporting. But I'm saying, right? Like, hey, look the other way. This guy's okay. His father's one of ours. How can you tell the difference when America's on all sides of this war all the time? And speaking of which, Shane Bauer's going to be here. When I first interviewed Shane Bauer, he was reporting on American support for Iran's death squads in Iraq. The Bada Brigade torture murderers who America served, kicking all the Sunni Arabs out of Baghdad and relieving the Shia of any Shia power factions, that is, the politicians, not all of them, you know, in the country, relieving them of any incentive to really deal with the Sunnis or try to compromise with them at all, the Sunni power factions, that is, the tribal leaders and the local imams and etc. Because, hey, we got the capital city, so screw you. And then he later was kidnapped and detained by the Iranian junta for, I think, a few years. And is now writing about prison and police issues for Mother Jones, doing his part to try to keep America from becoming too much more like the Iranian police state, like it already is. So that's coming up on the show today, too. That's pretty good, right?
Hey, Al Scott here.
Ever wanted to help support the show and own silver at the same time? Well, a friend of mine, libertarian activist Arlo Pignatti, has invented the alternative currency with the most promise of them all. QR Silver Commodity Discs. The first ever QR code 1-ounce silver pieces. Just scan the back of one with your phone and get the instant spot price. They're perfect for saving or spending at the market. And anyone who donates $100 or more to the Scott Horton Show at scotthorton.org/donate gets one. That's scotthorton.org/donate. And if you'd like to learn and order more, send them a message at commoditydiscs.com or check them out on Facebook at /commoditydiscs. And thanks. All right, guys. Now listen, if you don't know me, if you're new around here and you don't have a history of listening to me be right about everything for years on end or something, then you might think that this is crazy. This can't be right. The guy who did the attack in Canada, his father, according to theglobeandmail.com, which is basically out front on this entire story, the suspect, Michael Zihoff Bibo, 32 years old, his father is a Quebec businessman who appears to have fought in 2011 in Libya. And meanwhile, his mother is the deputy chair of a division of Canada's Immigration and Refugee Board. Mm-hmm. Here in America, all the right clamoring to close the border to keep people out. In Canada, they won't let you leave, even if you've proven that you're ready to commit high treason at any time and go and join the enemy. Now, I know it's confusing for a young jihadist when the Western powers take the side of the jihadists sometimes. I know it's confusing for American listeners who think, who is this kook on the radio saying that even Obama, the secret Muslim Kenyan whatever thing that people believe, that he's actually taken the side of America's enemies in Libya and in Syria. And yet, yeah, that's just the case. Now, I don't mean that he's been outright sending arms directly to ISIS. He's been outright sending a hell of a lot of humanitarian aid to them, as reported in the Daily Beast, which is Newsweek online, basically. That's all it is. So that's as official as you can get there. It's a very well-reported story, including State Department spokesman talking all about it and explaining all about it and everything. There's no big, it's a scoop, but it's not controversial as to whether it's true or not. But America, first in 2011, took the side of the protesters in the street against Muammar Gaddafi, where they should have stayed out. And what Gaddafi did was he started bombing them and killing the people in the street and saying, you're not protesting me the hell out of here. I win, you lose. This was what the Mubarak regime in Egypt was unable to get the military to do. The lower down junior officers and their foot soldiers would not carry out attacks like that on the people in Tahrir Square because there was just too many of them. It was the consensus of all of Egyptian society here, and the army was on the side of the people in that one. No such dynamic in Tripoli there. So Gaddafi said, screw you. He didn't even really have much of a military. Mostly only had his own personal Gestapo because he was worried about just that kind of thing. So, anyway, Hillary Clinton decided this would be a great PR stunt since America looked evil for supporting every dictator in the region, but especially Mubarak, the last 30 years, when even TV had to admit the people of Egypt were the good guys and Mubarak was the bad guy, and how kind of inconvenient it was that America had supported this bad guy all along. So they said, well, we're going to confuse this narrative. As Hillary Clinton put it, as reported by Michael Hastings, we need to get the Arab Spring try again to get off on the right foot, meaning how does the American empire, with their Saudi allies especially, hijack this thing and use it to our own advantage. Instead of having all of our sock puppet dictators overthrown, how do we use it to for our PR? The first and easiest target was Gaddafi, and they brought him in from the cold in 2003, but that just made him so he was ripe for a backstab, and that's what they did. And Obama pretended to believe for a minute that Gaddafi was going to kill every last man, woman, and child in the town of Benghazi if only America and the Western powers didn't set up a no-fly zone and start the war. And from the moment they set up the no-fly zone, as I warned you, The premise of the no-fly zone is these people aren't safe as long as Gaddafi's in power. So the next step from there, in D.C. they call this calculus. I call it basic arithmetic. The next step from there is, well, I guess Gaddafi's got to go then, huh? And so that's exactly what they did. And they waged a 9-month air war supporting special forces and Mujahideen on the ground. Guys who were proud and avowed veterans of the Afghan and Iraq wars where they fought against American soldiers. These are guys who, whether or not they had directly worked for Zarqawi or not, which they probably would have, but they would have been called by our government, Al-Qaeda in Iraq. Any Libyan, Saudi, Syrian, Jordanian coming to fight in the Iraq war as basically helpers for the Sunni-based insurgency there, our government certainly would have called them Al-Qaeda in Iraq, and they probably would have been right about that. That would have been more or less the group that they were fighting under. You know, obviously not uniformly, but pretty damn close anyway. And so here are these guys from the Libyan Islamic Fighting Group, Hasidi was his last name. I forget his first name. I think it was Abdullah Hasidi. And he's in the London Telegraph saying, yeah, I shot Americans in Iraq. What? And then there's this guy, Bel Hodge, who nowadays you can find him on CNN palling around with Christian Amanpour wearing a suit and tie and stuff. But he was Al-Qaeda in Iraq as well and admits it. And at one point, I'm not saying this is okay, but at one point he was kidnapped by the CIA and the MI6 and was brought to a dungeon in Thailand and tortured before being turned back over to Muammar Gaddafi to be tortured. I'm not saying that's right, but he was an Al-Qaeda guy. And but in the war, Obama took his side. And he's now one of the leaders of one of these attempted governments in the hellscape, you know, wasteland that is modern-day Libya with warring militias all over the place. And so then Obama, I know it sounds crazy. I know you don't want to believe me. But yeah, then again, you already know it's true anyway. Then they turned on Assad in Syria. And yeah, there was a protest movement there. But there were plenty of jihadists in Syria ready to take it as their own, and there were plenty of foreign powers who were happy to see that same policy, most especially the Americans, the Israelis, and the Saudis, as well as the Qataris and the Turks. All those guys hate Assad. Now, Clinton and Bush had found him useful, torturing Mujahideen for the United States for a while and that kind of thing. But really, he's aligned with Russia and Iran. And Barack Obama just outright explained, no problem about it, no controversy about it, explained to Jeffrey Goldberg at The Atlantic that, yes, if we could get a change of regime in Damascus and get rid of Assad there, then that would take Iran down a peg. That would weaken Iran. Because other than Iraq, they never say this part, other than Iraq, which George Bush handed to Iran on a golden platter, Syria is the only Arab ally they've got. And so, that's the consolation prize. America gave 2/3 of Iraq to Iran, but maybe we can try to take out Assad. And so, the Saudis, the Turks, the Qataris, the Americans backed the Mujahideen war in general against Assad this whole time. And the different, you know, America did try to back these so-called moderate groups of FSA guys. But the only thing moderate about them is that they're more criminals than they are bin Ladenite kooks. But that's it. They're not moderate at all. And they benefited the bin Ladenites this whole time, leading to the declaration of the caliphate.
Hey, y'all. Scott Horton here for WallStreetWindow.com. Mike Swanson knows his stuff. He made a killing running his own hedge fund and always gets out of the stock market before the government-generated bubbles pop. Which is, by the way, what he's doing right now. Selling all his stocks and betting on gold and commodities. Sign up at WallStreetWindow.com and get real-time updates from Mike on all his market moves. It's hard to know how to protect your savings and earn a good return in an economy like this. Mike Swanson can help. Follow along on paper and see for yourself. WallStreetWindow.com.
All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. So, I'm sorry, you know me, it always takes me a long time to get around to what the hell I'm trying to get at here. And that is that, as unbelievable as it is, the Americans decided that they would take the side of the Mujahideen, Sunni-based insurgency, in Libya and Syria over the last few years, leading up to the current catastrophe. And now we're suffering what I like to call the backdraft. It's a little bit more immediate than blowback, a little bit more obvious. Blowback is the consequences from covert foreign policy. Then the American people are left basically at the mercy of the government to explain why things happen. Well, the planes came out of the clear blue sky, I guess. Liars, start filling in gaps, please. You know? And that's blowback. But this is backdraft. This, like the declaration of the caliphate in Syria, what's happened here with this kid in Syria and Iraq, what's happened here with this, not kid, he's 32 years old, with this guy, this man in Canada, is backdraft. It's a consequence of this policy. It's direct. It's not secret. Everybody knows. I mean, actually, the war on Libya might be a secret from the American people. Not that it was classified or anything, but just nobody cared enough to even pay attention, to even care that there was a war in 2011. There was a war against Libya in 2011? People have asked me that numerous times. I know I've said that on the show, but it's been said to me repeatedly. There was a war in Libya? Huh. Against what? That guy Gaddafi from back in the Reagan thing? Huh. People didn't even know about it. So I guess it might as well have been classified. Might as well have been a clandestine, covert, whatever the hell. But anyway, here this guy is the son of Al-Qaeda. Good Al-Qaeda. For Obama and King Abdullah's purposes back in 2011. He wants to go. It says here he intended to travel to Libya to study Islam, but was unable to secure valid travel documents from Canadian officials. That's at the Globe and Mail. So, anyway, there it is, blown up right in your face. And now Glenn Greenwald has gotten himself in a bunch of trouble for writing the same thing that he always wrote. The only problem is now he's huge mungus. Before, he was the best thing that ever happened to Salon.com. Well, I don't know, I always really appreciated Max Blumenthal's father, Sidney Blumenthal's articles about the neocons there. He had some really good stuff to say. But anyway, of course, always been a big Greenwald fan for years and years, but now he's just huge. He's worldwide, and he's in what I really think is his best role, and that is blogger. And it's true about Glenn that he doesn't get all into the very deepest details of, you know, revisionist history of secret stuff, like, say, I don't know, Ronald Reagan's coke pushing or whatever like that. That's not really his beat, right? He's more about what they're lying about today, why the New York Times says what it says, why it's not true, but why it is that they want us to think that it is, and this kind of thing, right? And he's a pretty much a center-left Democrat. He's just really hardcore about things being true or not, and he's really hardcore about the Bill of Rights. And actually, he's really damn good on the wars, too. But, you know, as far as the rest of his political positions, I think he's a pretty conventional Democrat, right? He's not like a left radical or whatever. But that means that he's great for engaging with these, you know, basically the center-right establishment idiots. And so he's written this article saying, listen, Canada has been at war for nearly a decade and a half. For anyone in Canada to pretend that they couldn't have the slightest idea why any Muslim would attack Canadian soldiers other than their hateful extremist interpretation of Islam or whatever is just patently ridiculous and dishonest. It's the war. It's the fighting. And yet now that Glenn Greenwald is such a big deal, and he's been saying this forever, of course he's right about this. He's been saying this for many years, but he's drawn all this fire. And it's really telling, I think, about where we still are in 2014 in the leaders of American opinion. If you are stuck to Twitter like me and you see how they are, Ooh, the kindergartner's cry. I'm telling on you, Glenn Greenwald. Look, everybody, Glenn Greenwald said that Canada deserved it, derp. And yet, of course, he wrote in there, this is a matter of causation. It's not a matter of excusing it or anything else. Give me a break, you know? If you smoke, I think, this was in the update. He says, if you smoke cigarettes your whole life and then you get emphysema, and someone points out that it was the cigarettes what caused the emphysema, yeah, well, that doesn't mean that you're celebrating the disease and the person succumbing to it. You might love that person and want nothing more in the world but for them to be okay. Explaining a cause and effect does not mean that you're celebrating the effect. Stupid. But here we are in 2014, and this went on all day yesterday, and then this morning I saw Jeffrey Goldberg's tweet. Glenn Greenwald says Canada had it coming. Come on. Is that really the best you guys can do? I mean, it's obvious that the truth is that the enemy is American and Western foreign policy in the Muslim world. That's what's caused the terrorists' war against us, is our government's war against them first. It's just as simple as that. There's no question about that. And so what else are they going to say? Well, I guess they hate us because they're Muslim. No, they're Muslim because that happens to be the countries that you have the worst policy against and they have no recourse whatsoever because you control all their sock puppet dictators, their kings and their sultans and their emirs that you prop up and keep in power. I mean, come on, this is stupid. So what else do they have? Oh, they hate us because they're Islamic extremists and because we're good. And it doesn't matter the fact that we live in the future now. It's 2014 now. Why did this guy do this week? He didn't do it before. You know, I don't know. But Glenn Greenwald's in such hard water. So my advice to him was, listen, when you're going to write an article like this, you shouldn't just talk about post-September 11th. Because you give them such an easy out then, right? Well, listen, we had to do what we had to do after September 11th because they attacked us for no reason then. No, go back to 1993 at least. Ramzi Youssef wrote a letter to the New York Times explaining why he tried to topple one World Trade Center tower over into the other. It was all about American support for the Israelis in Palestine and the bombing and blockading of Iraq. It's right there, read and weep. Go and read, and all you got to do is go to the PBS website. You don't have to go to some jihadist terrorist forum. And go to the NewsHour PBS website and read Osama bin Laden's declarations of war against the United States from 1996 and 1998, and they both say, yeah, it's because of American foreign policy, and he explains at length what those policies are. Same thing for Mohammed Atta, the lead hijacker in the United States, and I guess pilot on Flight 11, or was it 75 or whatever? I forget. Mohammed Atta, and how his history, how he filled out his last will and testament during Israel's war against the people of southern Lebanon in 1996, Operation Grapes of Wrath, which also features prominently in bin Laden's declaration of war of 96. Clinton, who could have had bin Laden killed in Sudan, instead had them kick him out of the country and send him off to Afghanistan, where at least he can't hurt anybody from there. It is exile, after all, they thought. And then as soon as he got there, he published this declaration of war, and it goes on and on at length about Israel's the Qana massacre in southern Lebanon, whatever. Anyway, that's the history of Mohammed Atta and the rest of the ringleader Hamburg cell hijackers. Everybody knows that. Oh, John Kerry's Mideast peace talks have gone nowhere. Hey, all, Scott Horton here for the Council for the National Interest at councilforthenationalinterest.org. U.S. military and financial support for Israel's permanent occupations of the West Bank and Gaza Strip is immoral, and it threatens national security by helping generate terrorist attacks against our country. And face it, it's bad for Israel, too. Without our unlimited support, they would have much more incentive to reach a lasting peace with their neighbors. It's past time for us to make our government stop making matters worse. Help support CNI at councilforthenationalinterest.org. All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, the Scott Horton Show. And let me see here. Oh, yeah. I was supposed to be reading Shane Bauer during the break. I got to remember to get this article read before it's time to interview him. Oh, I'll get it done at the next break. It's 9 minutes long. It'll be fine. All right. And now, our friend Phil Giraldi from the Council for the National Interest, he's over here at the American Conservative Magazine, former CIA officer. Full disclosure, he's a former CIA officer. Well, he's got this article, John McCain's Terrorists. And he talks about how, well, Rand Paul was overspeaking a bit when he said that John McCain went and met with ISIS over there. He didn't meet with ISIS. He met with the Northern Storm Brigade, who apparently the CIA and our special forces or somebody decided it would be okay for him to meet with. They were backing these guys. They were part of the Free Syrian Army. This was in 2012. And so Rand Paul said, oh, John McCain met with the ISIS over there. So John McCain and the Daily Beast and everybody said, oh, and shouted Rand Paul down. And Rand Paul should not be such a lazy dilettante. He actually ought to know things before he speaks of them. And then he could be right and win all the time instead of getting caught being half right. Because here's how half right he was. Check it out. The Northern Storm Brigade, before John McCain ever went to Syria to meet with them, Time Magazine had already interviewed them on camera, put it online. In fact, if you just search, watch me right now. I'm just going to copy and paste Northern Storm Brigade from this freaking article, and I'm going to put it in my toolbar here in my Google search there, and watch what happens, man. Well, let's see. Landis. Oh, well, there's more ever since this part of the story break. Oh, here it is. No, it's still, what is the fifth result? Fifth result. Video. Inside Syrian rebel group, the Northern Storm Brigade. And their leader explains that he is a veteran of the Iraq War, where he fought against Americans. Inside Syrian rebel group, Northern Storm. This is what a great job the CIA and the special forces, and this specific point isn't in Giraldi's article. I don't think he knows about the Time Magazine thing. But this goes to show what a great job the special forces and the CIA are doing of vetting these guys, if indeed they're vetting them at all. They had already told Time Magazine, yeah, the leader had said, yeah, I'm a veteran of the Iraq War. He was one, again, during the Iraq War, go back in time with me, 10 years, 9 years, 8 years, 7 years. Any Syrian fighting with the Sunni-based insurgency in Iraq was called Al-Qaeda in Iraq, the worst of the worst Mujahideen terrorist bad guys. Who, the fact that they never existed there before the invasion didn't matter. They were the justification for the occupation's continuation. That whole time. Remember them? Al-Qaeda in Iraq? We now call them al-Nusra in Syria and ISIS in Syria and Iraq. Yeah, those same guys. Not just the Sunni-based insurgency, but the bad guys, the suicide bombers, the prisoner beheaders, the marketplace butchers. And I don't mean the good kind of butchers who sell you meat. I mean the kind of guys who send suicide bombers to attack women and children at the market. Sick bastards. The worst of them. And so that was before McCain met with them. That was before McCain met with them. Now it turns out they were the ones who sold this journalist, this American journalist, Stephen Sotloff, to ISIS. So, you know, Phil makes the most important point here, which is, you know, I tried to mention a couple of times. Nice vetting of moderate rebels. Phil goes on to say, unless you got eyeball scans of everybody and you can really keep track of them all, you can't keep track of them all. So the whole thing is basically a farce. That's basically what he ends with on that point. This is a brief column for the magazine, I guess. But anyway, so that's one major point, is What's so moderate about the FSA? All these guys, as Patrick Coburn's been telling us for years, they're all interchangeable with each other. If you ask the FSA guys, how do you like that September 11th attack? They say, yeah, we want to see more like that. Just the same way that that's what al-Nusra answers and that's what ISIS answers too. Killing Americans? Hell yeah. Taking weapons from Americans? Yeah, we'll take that too. If we get a chance, we'll use them on them too. That's what they're about. How are you going to vet these rebels when they couldn't even vet these guys before McCain met with them? And then, of course, the other point is a political point, but it's also kind of a pet peeve of mine, and that is Rand Paul blowing his opportunity here to say to John McCain, here's the truth of what you did. It's right there at Time Magazine. Just search Northern Storm Brigade in Google. It comes right up. There's the leader of Northern Storm saying, yeah, I fought Americans in Iraq. What? You can call them Northern this, Northern that, or any other name that you want to. They're veterans of the Iraq War, where they apparently, I don't guess he says exactly to the Time Magazine reporter, yes, I shot Americans to death, but might as well have. Certainly John McCain would have thought so a few years back. He would have said, Assad is sending these guys to Iraq to help fight, right? And so, one, Rand Paul got it wrong. No, it wasn't ISIS. But, oh man, if he had only just got it right, it was the Northern Storm Brigade. And let me tell you about the Northern Storm Brigade, then man, it would have been perfect, because then it would have come out about 3 days later. That, yeah, and Northern Storm, they were the ones who sold Sotloff to ISIS that cut his freaking head off. John McCain's friends. And you know what? And this is true, man. This is a vetted report, and you can double, triple check me, and there ain't no way you could spin it, even if you love John McCain. Maybe you're his wife's drug dealer or something, and you really have, or you're part of the same fascist beer cartel in Arizona or that kind of thing. You love it. You can't deny, man. It's his own people told the Daily Caller he wanted to have a sleepover. John McCain wanted to have a sleepover. And it was the group that organized the thing and their security detail that forced him to leave. In fact, let me find the exact quote from you. It's O'Baggy. Elizabeth O'Baggy, you might remember, she was working for Fat Neck Fred Kagan's wife at the Institute for the Study of War there. And McCain, Syria, Storm, Caller, that's probably all I need there, right? McCain wanted to have sleepover. See, I always Google slumber party and it never comes up. It's sleepover. He wanted to have a sleepover. And so here he is, and it's Elizabeth O'Baggy. She's most known for pretending she had a PhD and getting fired by Fat Neck Fred Kagan's wife. But, you know, she was, cited by, John Kerry in the hearings before, sworn hearings before John McCain, where they agreed that, yes, the vast majority of the rebellion in Syria is secular. And the whole, audience started laughing. Or maybe that was just me. But she was the one that they were citing saying that. And so here is the direct quote from, according to her, the trip she arranged for the senator through the Syrian Emergency Task Force, just so that we have that established fact. The rebels had opened up their doors and were welcoming McCain to stay and have dinner at their house and to stay the night. It was a very fascinating trip. It was really great to see an American politician reach out to the Syrian people in ways that no one else has done. McCain's communications director, Brian Rogers, confirmed O'Baggy's account. His communications director, his spokesman, confirmed the account. Yes, Rogers wrote in an email to the Daily Caller. He wanted to visit with them longer, including until the next day. Senator McCain's security detail was forcing him to leave and was pushing him out the door and wanted to get him back to Turkey. McCain wanted to stay the night. This is a direct quote now from his spokesman, okay? This is not the Daily Caller paraphrasing and me paraphrasing the Daily Caller. This is the Daily Caller at least claiming that they're directly quoting an email. They're copying and pasting an email from John McCain's spokesman. Okay, I don't think this is in dispute here. He wanted to stay the night. Senator McCain wanted to stay the night and learn more about the rebels. He didn't need pizza. They said they didn't need pizza. They needed weapons. Blah, da, blah, da, blah. There it is. At the Daily Caller. John McCain and his terrorist buddies, indeed. If only Rand Paul would read.
Hey, all Scott here. If you're like me, you need coffee. Lots of it. And you probably prefer it tastes good, too. Well, let me tell you about Darren's Coffee Company at darrenscoffee.com. Darren Marion is a natural entrepreneur who decided to leave his corporate job and strike out on his own, making great coffee. And Darren's Coffee is now delivering right to your door. Darren gets his beans direct from farmers around the world. All specialty, premium grade, with no filler. Hey, the man just wants everyone to have a chance to taste this great coffee. Darren's Coffee. Order now at darrenscoffee.com. Use promo code Scott and save $2. Darrenscoffee.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton, and this is my show, The Scott Horton Show. All right, now, as promised, I got some more clips from that Crystal Cheney interview to play for you here. Oh, I just can't help it. Bill Crystal interviewed Dick Cheney. Yeah, no, really. And so day before last, I played quite a few of these clips for you about them talking about the horror of withdrawal from Vietnam that neither of them fought in. And then they're talking about the first Gulf War. I played clips on the first Gulf War and that kind of thing. Anyway, so this one is the part of the interview where they talk about September 11th for a while, and I didn't think there's anything very quotable out of that. Or if I did, it's included here, whatever it is. Mostly they talk about what they did after the September 11th attack in reaction. Some of that's been kind of controversial. And so Cheney and Crystal, then they discuss NSA spying, and they discuss torture, and they do not discuss the Iraq War at all. Iraq War 2. They talk about Iraq War 1 in this interview. It's a two-hour interview. Bill Crystal interviewing Dick Cheney. Bill Crystal, leading neocon outside of official power, editor at the Weekly Standard, editor of the Weekly Standard, and a regular contributor on all the morning news shows and all that crap, Fox News Sunday and whatever. The guy with the big grin, like he's getting away with blue bloody murder. You know the one I mean. The guy with the softest hands in all of Washington, D.C. The toughest guy out of them all. And he's interviewing Dick Cheney, the vice president, who was, George W. Bush's Colonel House, who told him what to do. So, here they are, and they spend an inordinate amount of time on Nixon's resignation, on the Gerald Ford years, and his entire, all the little, and then Donald Rumsfeld got on a plane and went back to Europe to be in charge of NATO for another little while, and just every little side point to make that means nothing. And then, when it comes time to talk about the war, they don't even say one word about the war in Iraq. That's conservatism. You know, they put a real emphasis on personal responsibility.
Or no. So it was a life-altering experience, I think, for an awful lot of us, especially those of us who were in the bunker that day.
See, that's where this clip begins. That was the thing he said about 9/11 that I thought was notable. You know who was really affected by September 11th? Me, says Dick Cheney, the coward, who, oh, no, really, they grabbed me by the arms and they made me go down into the bunker. They didn't even say please. Oh, it was quite frightening, Bill, I tell you what. Of all the people in America affected by September 11th. I'm the one biggest victim of all.
So it was a life-altering experience, I think, for an awful lot of us, especially those of us who were in the bunker that day trying to deal with the crisis as it unfolded.
And all in all, looking back, I'm sure there are things you now think you could have done differently, but I personally think the Bush administration, the Bush-Cheney administration did a much better job than people appreciate if you think how things could have gone over the next 7 years. But any particular lessons or thoughts and sort of now 6 years later than the end of that administration, what, 13 years after 9/11?
Yeah.
Hard to believe, actually.
Well, I thought we did pretty well. Some of the decisions we made were controversial. They are to this day. I still defend them. Things like the terror surveillance program, which created great flap over the NSA, and the assumption is the NSA's, you know, listening into your phone call to Aunt Fanny. They aren't.
Right.
To my knowledge, that program's always been operated to the highest standards, very careful to protect people's civil liberties. And another program was very controversial. It was enhanced interrogation techniques. But when you do have the kind of problem we had, and you've got a handful of individuals, the terrorists and the leadership of the terrorists, who know what's going to happen next or know how they did the last one. We didn't know a lot about al-Qaeda. We knew about the organization. We knew bin Laden. But when we began to capture high-value detainees, especially in Afghanistan, and people like Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, the mastermind of 9/11, what are you going to do? Just say, please, please, pretty please, tell us what you know? It's not going to work. This guy's going to die for all if he gets a chance and kill every American he can in the process. So we developed a series of techniques. They're not new in the sense that they're the same techniques we use training our own pilots and our own people who may find themselves potentially captured by the enemy at some point. And waterboarding is part of that process. The guy who got waterboarded more than anybody else was KSM. The CIA produced a report subsequently in about 2004 that said Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, preeminent source on al-Qaeda. That's where we got most of our information about al-Qaeda was from. Khalid Sheikh Mohammed.
And he was saw the intelligence every day after that. And you do believe, I mean, just confirming this, that it saved a lot of lives.
I do indeed believe that.
Prevented subsequent
attacks. It prevented another mass casualty attack against the United States for the next 7.5 years. And I'm very familiar with the program. I was actively involved in helping get it started and supporting it. And I don't think we have any apologies to make. I think if a similar situation today, I would do exactly the same thing. And if you get to the terror surveillance program, there was a point where some controversy had arisen about it. We set the program up back in 2001 and about 2004. There had been leaks and so forth. And we'd briefed the Congress, but always kept it very small, just the chairman and ranking member on the Intel Committee. But on this day, we brought down the leadership. We had the Speaker, the Majority and Minority Leader, the Majority and Minority Leader in the Senate, the chairman and ranking member of the Intel Committee. So all of them, Situation Room, called in Mike Hayden, who was then running NSA and running that program, had Mike brief on what we were doing and what we were getting out of it. And then I went around the room and asked anybody, I said, does anybody here think we should close this program down? Absolutely not. Nobody wanted to close it down. Too valuable. The room contained Nancy Pelosi. Nancy was there in her role on the Intel Committee. The second question I asked was, well, do you think we should come to the Congress and get more authorization for what we're doing? I said, absolutely not. If you're bringing up there, it'll leak. This was the unanimous view in the room. Now, a lot of people have forgotten after it became controversial that they signed up to it, signed off on it. But it was a great program. It was very well done. Both of those programs were. And I think when all is said and done, that's two of the most important things we did. And that counts in no small part for the fact that we kept the country safe for the next 7.5 years.
Yeah. Well, so a few things there. First of all, on the NSA spying thing, it's absolutely outrageous. Are you kidding me? The whole Stellar Wind thing, sweeping up everything. And they can't name a single plot that they thwarted with that Stellar Wind. Not one. It's a bunch of crap. And it was completely illegal. And if Congress signs off on it, that doesn't change the fact that it was completely illegal. You know what changed the fact that it is completely illegal? If 2/3 of both houses of Congress and 3/4 of all the state legislatures agreed to repeal the Fourth Amendment, then it would be just fine. Otherwise, no. That's it. Black and white issue. Simple as that. Everybody knows that. Haven't you ever read the Fourth Amendment before with your eyeballs and what it says there? Give me a break. That's nothing. Ah, that's the damn music already. That's nothing to what all he says about torture. I'll get back to that in just a second. But you notice how he keeps saying the next 7.5 years, the next 7.5 years. At least he's willing to acknowledge that was his responsibility. It was on his watch that 3,000 were killed on 9/11. Thanks for reminding us, Dick, in case we forgot. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. I want to tell you about this great new book, Livin' La Vida Baroka, American Culture in an Age of Imperial Orthodoxies by Thomas Harrington. While he comes from the left, Harrington has little time for much of what is passed off under that label today. Like us libertarians, he puts peace and freedom first. The book's got great essays on American fascism, empire, the Israeli occupation, the left and Obama, liberalism in the state, and some interesting lessons from the history of Imperial Spain. Livin' La Vida Baroka by Thomas Harrington. Check it out at scotthorton.org/books or scotthorton.org/Amazon. All right, y'all. Welcome back. So, I'm Scott Horton. Playing these clips of Bill Kristol interviewing Dick Cheney. And just very briefly, because I want to play the last clip and get this over with here. But what he says there about the torture, he's confessing to being guilty of a felony, a federal felony. Many, many counts of it. Torture, see, is against the law. And there's a international treaty. There's the War Crimes Treaty and the Torture Treaty, both outlaw torture. And they both have federal laws enforcing them. And the American federal government already has federal laws against those things separately anyway. And so does every state in the union. See, so Dick Cheney, he's a criminal and he's a war criminal. And he's proud to brag about it because it's the only defense he has, is that screw you. This is a policy difference. You can't criminalize a disagreement about policy. No, you're a criminal. Torture's illegal, and you're guilty of it. And so prison, assuming there was such a thing as a rule of law, then it would be prison for you. That's the deal. And then as far as the Khalid Sheikh Mohammed thing, they would have got him to talk eventually. When they finally did get him to talk, I don't know what all he actually told the CIA, but I know that in his confession at Guantanamo Bay, took credit for every terrorist attack since RFK, man. He took credit for faking the moon landing and everything else. The thing is completely ridiculous, and no one believed it. The mass media was like, well, you know, tortured people say lots of things. Yeah, really, huh? So what did they get out of him that was valuable, and how could they tell the difference between what was valuable and what wasn't? Apparently, they never got him to point his finger at Saddam Hussein, which would have been the big get. But anyway, and then he says, well, the number one most waterboarded person was Khalid Sheikh Mohammed. Yeah, well, the number two most waterboarded person was Abu Zubaydah, who was actually not an al-Qaeda kingpin, who was actually more like a low-level travel agent type, and who couldn't give up the goods on all of 9/11 because he didn't have them. He couldn't give up all the goods on all of al-Qaeda because he didn't have them. And this is the one where when the CIA broke the news to George W. Bush, oh, please Google me and double-check. When George Tenet, the head of the CIA, told President George W. Bush, hey, you know, this guy Zubaydah who you keep talking about in front of the cameras and stuff, he's actually not nobody. And Bush said, you're not going to make me lose face on this, are you? And George Tenet said, oh, no, sir. No, we'll go right on pretending he was somebody important if those are your orders, boss. You're not going to make me lose face on this. I said he was important, Bush insisted. From Ron Susskind's journalism there. And anyway, the waterboarding is the least of it anyway. There were only, you know, maybe what, a half dozen people were waterboarded? Thousands and thousands and thousands of Iraqis, Afghans, and people from all over the world in either of those countries were tortured by the U.S. government, mostly by the military. The CIA tortured, who knows, hundreds and hundreds. and in lawless black site prisons all over the world. But the military, as Tony Lugaranis, or Logaranis? I've been saying it wrong. Is it Lagaranis? It's in the PBS Frontline documentary, The Torture Question. He explains that, oh no, see man, we tortured them up and down the street, in their houses. Some of these guys would break the guys, the interrogatees would break their feet, break their foot bones with the back of an axe handle. That's how we soften them up for questioning. And then especially after the Abu Ghraib thing, oh man, you can't do it in the prison in front of everybody. So we just stay with them in their house that we raided and torture them in their house in front of their wife and kids. Thousands and thousands. Because the word was out. The law doesn't apply in this case for some reason. David Addington, etc., etc., Dick Cheney's staff, they decided that there is no law, and certainly not one that protects anyone who resists our occupation of Iraq and Afghanistan from anything that we feel like doing to them. You can ask Stanley McChrystal all about it, he and his guys and all their torture regime at Camp Nama. Which Camp Nama, what did Nama stand for again? It was something mean. Anyway, thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands and thousands of innocent people were tortured. And you know, the Army agreed, the Red Cross, the Army admitted to the Red Cross that, yeah, I guess it was one office in the Army that didn't care about the other office in the Army to tell the truth or whatever. I don't know. So they just said, yeah, it's true. 90% of the guys that we got were innocent of anything. We couldn't find anything on them. They were just rounded up in these massive sweeps, which were, you know, mostly part of the sectarian cleansing of Baghdad. Again, Bush serving the Ayatollah and his militias. 90% of them innocent. Tortured all over the place. And anyway, so, oh no, but you know who only got tortured? The guy most responsible for the 9/11 attack other than the pilots themselves. Oh yeah, we tortured him, but so what? Says Dick Cheney. Well, first of all, that's against the law. That's so what? And second of all, torture is wrong even if it is Khalid Sheikh Mohammed, who is guilty and who bragged about his guilt to Al Jazeera before he ever got caught. And is the uncle of Ramzi Youssef, the guy that tried to blow up the World Trade Center in 93. You know, it's not like it's a big mystery who this guy is or where he comes from. Anyway, so screw him. But Dick Cheney doesn't have the authority, right? You know, if Khalid Sheikh Mohammed tried to escape and the sharks got him, I don't care what the sharks do to him. The sharks have the authority to do whatever they want. It's their ocean. But Dick Cheney doesn't have the authority to torture people. That's the thing of it, see? And Khalid Sheikh Mohammed was the least of the torture. Oh, so they drowned him almost to death a few times. That's nothing compared to what Dick Cheney did to the people of Iraq. And he knows it, and we all know it. But hey, let's all just pretend not. See, now I've taken up this whole segment just analyzing that last clip. That son of a bitch. Oh, and then here, while I'm almost out of time, I got 45 seconds to say. And then he acknowledges in pretending, oh, it's not that bad. It's just the same techniques we use on American airmen when we're training them. You know, the SEER techniques, survival, evasive resistance, or whatever the hell it is. And yet we know where those techniques come from. They're copied from Mao Zedong's little red torture book that he'd given to the North Koreans, that he'd gotten from the Russians, who, as Alfred McCoy teaches us, just like the Americans, had actually copied all these same torture methods from the Nazis themselves. I mean, not that they didn't have their own torture methods anyway in both camps. But a lot of that stuff comes from the Nazis and then flowed from the joint Soviet-American victory over Nazi Germany to both victors' countries, who then adopted those Nazi torture policies and then ended up meeting on the other side of the planet when America adopted these same techniques gone from the Soviets through Mao to North Korea, which they used on our guys. Isn't that fun? Read a Question of Torture. Torture Question is the documentary. A Question of Torture is Alfred McCoy's great book.
Hey, all, Scott here for Liberty.me, the brand new social network and community-based publishing platform for the liberty-minded. Liberty.me combines the best of social media technology all in one place and features nightly classes, guides, events, publishing, and so much more. Sign up now and you get the first 30 days free. And if you click through the link in the right margin at scotthorton.org or use the promo code Scott when you sign up, you'll save $5 per month for life. That's more than a third off the regular price. And hey, once you sign up, add me as a friend on there at scotthorton.liberty.me. Be free. Liberty.me.
All right, you guys, welcome back to the show. By the way, is it on the blog at antiwar.com? Let me see here. I know Eric was wanting to blog it. The ACLU, well, here's the deal. If you go to the spotlight today on antiwar.com, it's an ACLU report on Obama adopting Bush's line on the torture laws. They don't count. They also have this cool thing. It's an infographic. Oh, I know you like interactive infographics. Well, go to the spotlight article today on antiwar.com about torture and then click on the infographic. And what you'll get is this thing called the Torture Architects. And it goes to show all the people in charge at the top and their lawyers, DOJ, DOD, and CIA, of course, the White House at the very top, and all the people who are in on it. And what they're focused on is, yeah, like I say, the principals and their lawyers who said it was okay. And so, these are all guys who belong under the prison because that's the law. And in fact, there's a great clip I tweeted out earlier of George Carlin talking about all the criminal investigations of all the different members of the Reagan administration. And he says it's something like 200 criminal investigations of members of the Reagan administration. And I was thinking, wow, they don't do that anymore at all. I mean, I remember that from that time when I was a kid. It was possible to believe there was such a thing as anything approaching a system of a rule of law where the people in the government were just citizens, just like us, and the law applied to them, too. My dad taught me that that's how it worked. Why, just a couple of years before you were born, son, the president had to resign in disgrace because he broke the law. And they ran his ass out of town. So these things can happen, I was taught as a naive young boy at the end of the last century. But they don't even pretend. How many criminal investigations have they been into Bush or Obama? Eh. You know, I had a friend of mine, I think he was joking at the time, but it makes sense if you like conspiracies, that the whole Lewinsky plot, it wasn't an Israeli conspiracy to blackmail Bill Clinton and ruin the peace plan. That's the favorite conspiracy theory about it or whatever. No, it was all a plan by the Republicans and the Democrats to discredit the independent special prosecutor statute forever. So that then they could all get away with breaking whatever law they wanted forever. And they would hire Ken Starr to flog this dead horse for so long that everyone would decide that the real problem here is him and his office, the independent special prosecutor. And so they got rid of that. The independent counsel statute was repealed. As far as cause and effect, sure seems to have worked. I don't think the Israelis would have needed to blackmail Bill Clinton. What was he going to do about it? Yeah, nothing. That's what they thought. You gotta listen to Netanyahu mock Bill Clinton. Yeah, that was when I screwed him. Right in the face, he says. No, that's a rough paraphrase. But it's a secret camera, a hidden camera. I guess he thought that they'd turned it off, but they hadn't. And so he just goes on and on about Area C and how, oh yeah, I told Bill Clinton I was going to give the Palestinians a state, but I lied and he's such a jerk off. But don't worry about them. The settler asks him, hey, man, the colonist, hey, what if you piss off the Americans? Don't we kind of need them to like us, you know? And he says, oh, don't worry about the Americans. 80% of them support us. It's absurd. They're easily moved. Not something to be concerned about. So, anyway, that must have been it. They were trying to get rid of the independent counsel statute. Because just think of what fun a Ken Starr could have had if he had the bent and the power to investigate the Bush administration for torture. Oh, and for that matter, the Obama administration for torture, too. Because they've been participating in this same kind of thing, as reported by Scahill in, before him, hell, they were cooperating with the Ethiopians on rendition and torture from... that was still Bush. Yeah, but anyway, Scahill broke the story of the secret torture dungeon under Mogadishu, run by the CIA there. Well, with the help of the CIA, as they say. And then, of course, there's Appendix M, as we've talked about with Jeffrey Kay on the show, where they just rewrote what's torture in the field manual. They limited interrogation methods to what you find in the field manual, and then they rewrote the field manual to allow for temperature manipulation, which means freezing them nearly to death, sleep deprivation, and at least some forms of stress positions, I do believe. Should get Jeff Kay back on about that. But here now, I blew this whole freaking segment, didn't I? I don't have enough time. So now you have to wait until the next segment for me to play the last part of this, and then I guess you'll just have to do all the analyzing yourself, or most of it. It's just the consensus, you know, between Bill Kristol and Dick Cheney about what's going on in the world and what is to be done about it. I guess, again, most notably, they don't talk about the Iraq War at all. They have every opportunity in a 2-hour-long interview to talk about the war in Iraq, and they don't even acknowledge that it happened anywhere in the damn thing. Really. I read the whole thing, and I watched many parts of it. I was trying to queue up to the sound bites I wanted, but I watched, you know, a lot more than that, trying to look for those sound bites that I was looking for from my notes from when I read it. But they don't talk about Iraq. They do not talk about Iraq War II. Didn't exist. And I guess, I did have time. Have time? 39. Let me count on my finger. 4 minutes. Yeah, maybe just enough time.
We're in, there's talk about a possible coup attempt in terms of the government, and they've got 50 to 100 nuclear weapons.
The
guy that was building the Libyan program for Muammar Gaddafi was the father of the Pakistani program. Then he went into business for himself. He claimed publicly in the newspapers that the North Koreans got their uranium enrichment technology, which is now state-of-the-art, which is now operating a couple thousand centrifuges, that they got that by bribing Pakistani officials. So for us to look at that part of the world and think we can hide behind our ocean, everything's fine, that's crazy. You got to be a fool to believe isolationist strategy is the way to go. We have no choice but to be involved in that part of the world, and if we're not actively involved there, some very bad things are going to happen. I think if the Iranians get nuclear weapons, it will only be a short period of time before others in the region also have nuclear weapons. So we're in a very dangerous period. I think it's more threatening than the period before 9/11. I think 9/11 will turn out to be not nearly as bad as the next mass casualty attack against the United States, which, if and when it comes, will be something with far deadlier than airline tickets and box cutters.
I don't want to end on such a grim note. But you have hope. You have hope for the future.
Well,
what,
I do.
What actually gives you the most? Curious, honestly. I mean, what sort of...
When I look back at our history, we've been through some very difficult times before. Think about going from the Depression in the 1930s to World War II.
Yeah.
And we had a period of time then when, because of World War I and the League of Nations and the isolationist sentiment, America First sentiment, that was very strong back in the late 30s. Franklin Delano Roosevelt had to deal with a nation that was overwhelmingly hostile to the idea of American involvement abroad. We had a military at the time of Pearl Harbor was 17th in the nation. Romania had a bigger army than we did. We overcame all that and mounted that magnificent effort that was World War II and won a tremendous victory. And set the stage for 70 years, basically, of relative peace and stability in the world. That's in danger now, partly because there aren't very many people left to remember it, partly because we don't teach it in the schools anymore, partly because the technology gap has always worked to our advantage, is getting smaller and smaller vis-a-vis the Chinese, for example. And we get into the whole area of cyber warfare. They're very good at what they do, and they're working on it all the time. So I think we're entering a period of considerable danger with the United States that, relative to other nations, is weaker than we ought to be, that our military force is being dramatically reduced when it shouldn't be, and what we need is strong leadership. And we need a president and a Congress who understand the nature of the threat. Hopefully we will rise to the occasion now as we did in the past. But it's very important that we do so. This is not a time for us to rest on our laurels or think we can cut the defense budget and spend all that money on highways or whatever else we might want to spend it on. We really need.
Hey, I'm Scott Horton here to tell you about this great new book by Michael Swanson, The War State. In The War State, Swanson examines how Presidents Truman, Eisenhower, and Kennedy both expanded and fought to limit the rise of the new national security state after World War II. This nation is ever to live up to its creed of liberty and prosperity for everyone. We are going to have to abolish the empire. Know your enemy. Get The War State by Michael Swanson. It's available at your local bookstore or at Amazon.com in Kindle or in paperback. Just click the book in the right margin at ScottHorton.org or TheWarState.com.
That is such a weird starting place for that song coming back from that break. I keep forgetting to talk to Ian about that. And cut off that first note, you know, and then start with it. Yeah, it's my show. Sorry, I'm an idiot, man. If I had only not mistakenly thought I didn't have enough time, because I was looking at the wrong clock, I would have had enough time. And then I thought, oh, maybe I do have enough time. And then, of course, I didn't anymore. But whatever, man. I don't care. You do a radio show.
To the threat. Hopefully we will rise to the occasion now as we did in the past. But it's very important that we do so. This is not a time for us to rest on our laurels or think we can cut the defense budget and spend all that money on highways or whatever else we might want to spend it on. We really need a strong leader, and we need somebody who can step up and remind the world what the United States is capable of and demonstrate the ability and the willingness to do that.
Well, that's a good note, I think. I wish, Dan, I hope when we have that strong leader, if we will have such a strong leader in 2017, yeah. I hope his first phone call is to bring you into the White House, not to ask you to be vice president or chief of staff or SecDef, so that would be fine with me, but at least to get your counsel. And thank you so much, Mr. Vice President, for spending this time today. Thank you for your service over the years, which has really been exemplary, I think, just speaking personally for me as a model of what a public servant should do. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you, Bill.
And thank you for joining us again for Conversations.
All right. I'm sorry. I should have cut off the very end of that. But anyway, so that was the end of it, including the very end. But so there you have it. Yeah, boy, God, all we need is just a strong leader right now to lead us. That's conservatism. They pretend to be anti-government, the right, but this is where their heart really lies. Power. Power that they can identify with in some way. They love it. So here's the argument he makes. Pakistan has nukes, so we have to stay involved in that part of the world. We can't be isolationist. And yet, what does America do? America does nothing but destabilize Pakistan and help arm up India and use them to help destabilize Pakistan more. Use, you know, ally with them, do everything we can to get them, the U.S. government, to get them to build bases and help in Afghanistan, just making matters worse for the Afghans and worse for the Pakistanis there. And when was the last time you heard an American ambassador was actually sitting down over there and it leaked out, oh, it was a secret, really badass, top-level thing that they had? Or, hey, they really just announced it and had a big thing and had some talks because the Americans, loving peace so much, were calling together the leaders of India and Pakistan to sit down at the table and work out some kind of agreeable autonomy for Kashmir that both sides can accede to. There's a deal in there somewhere. Send George Mitchell. Send someone. Send them now. Send them ever. When has America ever done anything to try to resolve the problem of Pakistan's nuclear weapons? That's the problem of Pakistan's nuclear weapons. They could get into a nuclear war with India. How about a treaty where both sides disarm and get rid of their nuclear weapons? How about they each reduce their stockpile to 5? How about something? How about come to an agreement about the status of Kashmir so there's so much less to fight about? How about that? No, just, oh, yeah, we got to be military. We got to stay involved in that part of the world. Yeah, because Pakistan and Syria are all the same thing. You know, that general geographical region. That's what he said before. People said, man, why are we fighting a war in Iraq when they didn't have anything to do with Al-Qaeda or the 9/11 attack or any of this? You know, the terrorism problem comes from that general geographical area. Are you kidding me, man? That general geographical area. Say it. All the terrorists come from states that are the sock puppet dictatorships of the American Empire. That's pretty easy to say. Anyway, and then the next threat is Iran nukes. Well, they're not making nukes. They never were. Everybody knows Dick Cheney's a liar about that. He goes and he tries to invoke somewhere else in this interview. He pretends that Syria was trying to get nukes in 2006. That's a damn lie. My wife, among others, completely debunked that, that Syria was making a nuclear reactor at all. There was disagreement whether it was a missile depot or a radar station or whatever the hell it was, but it wasn't a nuclear reactor. And Larissa had IAEA sources who were on the ground there talking to her. So anyway, you know, the guy's doing the investigation. So that was a damn lie. But anyway, so, and Iran ain't making nukes. Everybody knows that. And then he says, yeah, and if Iran got nukes, then others in the region might get them. Really? You mean like Israel might then decide to get nukes? Or, oh, they stole the weapons-grade uranium from America back a couple of generations ago, and they've got hundreds of nukes, including H-bombs, and are holding the whole region hostage. Is that what you're trying to say? If America doesn't do what, then Iran will get a nuke. From this same liar we've heard this from forever in a row. Don't you think that if Iran was secretly making nukes for the last 35 years, that they would have one by now? One. How about just a single one? And in fact, the polls say Americans believe that Iran has nukes. And that's why. Because they rationalize it themselves. Well, geez, they were making nukes all this time, I think, right? So, yeah, they gotta have some. Because that's what a rational person would do if they started with the faulty premise that something TV said about what the politicians said about Iran and their nuclear program was correct. Then, yeah, they must have nukes by now, except they don't because they weren't making nukes this whole time. They never were. That ought to be proof enough, the fact they don't have them at all now. But anyway, then he evokes FDR finally... stopped getting, you know, knocked the American people. Oh, he totally, it's a non-starter. You know, because of the League of Nations, America was isolationist. Huh? No, because of the horrors of World War I that destroyed everything, that destroyed Western civilization, that led to the rise of communism and Nazism and fascism and the suicide of Europe. Yeah, because of that, the American people were anti-war. Which is isolationist, like a coward in the shadows of the past, if you listen to a warmongering right-wing imperialist nationalist like FDR or Dick Cheney. And so he invokes FDR, the fascist, and his spectacular, wondrous effort of World War II when it was really the Soviets who did all the work. Everybody knows that in fighting and defeating the Nazis. And then he says, and then we had an era of relative peace for 70 years. Really, huh? Yeah, don't tell that to any of your peers. You know, college classmates or any of those people who died in Vietnam or their fathers who died in Korea or the million-something who died in Indonesia, or the, you know, do all the proxy wars count? Once we start counting the proxy wars, it gets completely out of control. But anyway, it's been just an era of perfect calm in Dick Cheney's life this whole time. Let him tell the story. It's just a nonstop march to achievement. The American century, you might call it. Torture and all. Peace for 70 years. But now is certainly not the time to rest on our laurels, he says. Dick Cheney, the author of the Iraq War, the author of American torture, the author of the plenary and inherent powers of the president, whatever the hell that means, to do anything he wants. There's no law in the world that can bind his will because he is our great leader. This man says we must not rest on our laurels. We have problem spots, Al-Qaeda terrorism, which you'd have thought he would have defeated it. Right? But no. Al-Qaeda terrorism spread all across the world, and what's the one country he doesn't name where it exists now? Iraq. He goes, oh yeah, they're all across in North Africa, and then yada 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 in the Middle East, and then also over there like in Pakistan somewhere, he says. Again, refusing to even look at Iraq, refusing to even make eye contact with it, refusing to say its name. The crisis he created there. And then damn your parochial concerns he makes sure to mention at the end. You think you can get your highway remodeled? When we've got a war to win, we need a strong leader, Bill Kristol. A strong leader right now to prevent that. Vote Jeb. Hey, I'm Scott Horton here for The Future of Freedom, the monthly journal of the Future of Freedom Foundation. Edited by libertarian purist Sheldon Richman, The Future of Freedom brings you the best of our movement. Featuring articles by Richman, Jacob Hornberger, James Bovard, and many more, The Future of Freedom stands for peace and liberty and against our criminal world empire and Leviathan state. Subscribe today. It's just $25 per year for the back pocket size print edition, $15 per year to read it online. That's The Future of Freedom at fff.org/subscribe. Peace and freedom. Thank you. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. This is my show, Scott Horton Show, on Liberty Radio Network, noon to three weekdays. Full archives at scotthorton.org. More than 3,500 of them now. The interviews. More than 3,500 interviews now. Going back to 2003. Whole show archives for you, too, there, and a bunch of other stuff. Follow me on Twitter at Scott Horton Show, etc. Okay, good. Now, our guest is Shane Bauer, writing at Mother Jones Magazine, and this one is The Making of the Warrior Cop. You may well have noticed his tweets back during this gigantic SWAT team convention in San Francisco, I guess, about 6 weeks ago, something like that. Well, now the article's published. Welcome back to the show. How are you doing, Shane?
Good. Thanks for having me on.
Good. Very happy to have you here. So, tell us all about this convention. I guess, first of all, before the convention, if you could, tell us about this $1.9 billion that you talk about that has been transferred from the national government by different methods to the local police for the arming up of these SWAT teams across America.
Sure. Well, it's actually a lot more money than that. There's been a lot of attention on the Pentagon, issuing gear and weapons to local police. The Pentagon, since 1997, has issued $5.1 billion worth of equipment to local police. But Homeland Security has actually given $41 billion since 2002. And this is money. So it's like, money that goes to the police departments that they then use to buy from companies that were at this convention that I was at. So Homeland Security really, since 2002, has kind of created a huge industry. A lot of these companies that I saw formed in response to this kind of massive of funding from
Homeland
Security.
Now, is $41 billion, I mean, honestly, man, I don't know exactly how to measure how much money that is, how many M16s that buys, how many SWAT trucks for what. There's about 20,000 different local police departments, sheriff, county sheriff, and city police departments across America, mm-hmm. right? Something like that. Is there any way that you can kind of paint a picture for just, is that really overkill? I mean, assuming you want every cop to have a rifle and an armored
right.
personnel carrier, is this three times as much as you even need for that? Like, it's just an ultimate blank check?
I mean, I don't know what, like, the total budgets are, regular budgets are for police, so I couldn't tell you that. But this is money. I mean, this is aside from the kind of rifles and the regular stuff. They actually can't use this money for that. This is for the kind of APC-type vehicles, for that kind of, you know, armored gear, the military type gear, military clothing, drones, you know, the kind of additional equipment that police use. And another, actually, another huge pot of money is from civil forfeitures. And there was a company that was telling, that actually advertised this on their site. One of the companies that sells these huge APC type vehicles recommends that local police use money that they, and you know, property that they seize in criminal investigations, cars, houses, cash, and use that to buy these vehicles.
So in other words,
and that's even more than the DHS money.
Right. So, but it's so much that there really is no kind of downward pressure on them to stop at any point,
right?
Other than maybe the ACLU out there complaining or something like that. There really is no inside the government. There's no committee head in the land who wants to see an end
of this.
Yeah,
once you have this stuff, you know, once you have it, it's, you have kind of a, an incentive to use it. And, you know, something that one example that I think shows how powerful and important the industry side is Sheriff Joe Arpaio in Arizona recently gave back some of his equipment to the military, and he made this big show of it. And he, what he did was he displayed all of his new stuff, which he had bought from these companies, and was like, this stuff is way better. We don't need this old military stuff anymore.
Man. Yeah. Well, yeah. What fun if you're a sheriff, right?
Yeah.
This is perfect.
Yeah. And you know,
and with a bottomless
these,
budget.
These guys have grenade launchers now. Mm-hmm.
All right. Now, so now, I guess describe for people, in case, you know, Joey's got his mom listening to the show for the first time, scare the hell out of her. What kind of, I mean, obviously, okay, armored personnel carriers and M4 rifles, they've got lots of those. What else?
Yeah. So this convention was, you know, there were 2 days of this kind of exhibit hall, and some of the stuff that I saw there was, one thing was a device that you attach to a gun, and it shoots a radio frequency that blinds people for 10 minutes. And the guy, I asked the guy, what's the kind of technology behind this? And he said, it scrambles your ocular fluid. And he, you know, insisted that it doesn't cause any damage. There were drones, there were robots. Homeland Security was displaying a little kind of robot that you can print out in a 3D printer. That has a camera on it, so you could throw it like into the ventilation system of a building, something like that, to kind of go in and get video of the inside. You know, the kind of stuff you'd expect, like you said, guns, sniper rifles, that kind of thing. There's a, you know, one table was displaying a semi-automatic 308 and was, you know, telling me that the fish and game uses this now, you know, to go on patrols, not only to shoot bears, but to raid pot farms, that kind of stuff. And then, you know, then the other part of the convention was this 48-hour competition. There were 35 SWAT teams.
Oh, wait. No, hold that thought for a second. Let's talk about the equipment more. Because when it comes to the sniper rifles and stuff like that, I mean, you know, I don't know. Never mind my extreme libertarian political positions or whatever, but just I think a typical American might go, eh, I don't know. The sheriff's department has a couple of, you know, high-powered rifles for absolute emergency. You know, it doesn't sound necessarily that bad. I think what really has to be taken into account is the quantity of this stuff and the frequency with which it's used. There's not a hostage-taken bank robbery every day, but there is a SWAT team raid a day anyway.
Right. Yeah, and it's like half of the towns that, you know, are 50,000 people, or sorry, 80% of the towns that are less than 50,000 people have SWAT teams now. You know, it's been a huge ramping up in the last, you know, 10, 20 years of who has SWAT teams. I saw the University of California, Berkeley had a SWAT team there. There was a prison SWAT team that was competing, you know, in all these kind of small towns. You know, so you have these small towns with these big armored vehicles, guys coming out, you know, saw in Ferguson with these kind of high-powered rifles at protest situations. And then, you know, there's also changes that have happened in the last 10, 20 years as far as just weaponry is, you know, it used to be a police department had a couple of assault rifles, but now it's, you know, in most cities, the police cars have these now. So there's kind of a general you know, amping up, not just in SWAT teams, but across the board with policing in the kind of, you know, gear that, that police have. And I think something that's important to understand is, you know, the police will say, well, we need this to protect ourselves, you know, it's dangerous out there, it's dangerous work. But, you know, deaths of police have gone down, actual assaults on the police have gone down about 45% since their peak in 1971. Violent crime across the board in the U.S. is going down. So we're kind of seeing these, you know, if you charted this out, you're seeing lines go in the opposite direction with, you know, how violent the country is versus, you know, how kind of militarized our police are.
Mm-hmm. Well, and it is, not to beat anybody over the head with libertarianism or whatever, but it's sort of the basic, I think even some liberals agree about this, kind of the economics of bureaucracy where, you know, things like need have nothing to do with it at all. It's just how much do the cops want them and how much is available and how much money can we get spent, you know, which is not the way that people with a private fortune operate. How much of my money can get blown here? They only spend what they need to. But for the government, like that movie Falling Down, you know, they got to spend enough to justify spending more next year. And that goes for your local sheriff's M16 budget, too.
Yeah, and if, you know, if you're a local police force, this isn't your money you're spending. You're applying for grants from Homeland Security.
Right, yeah.
You know, and to get these grants, you just kind of, you know, they have to be terrorism related.
All right, now we got to stop and take this break, Shane. I'm sorry. I talked us all the way to the break. I always do that. I'm pretty bad at being a radio show host, really, but I try. It's Shane Bauer. He's written The Making of the Warrior Cop at MotherJones.com today. We'll be right back. Hey, Al Scott here for Whole Food Multicomplete at WholeFoodComplete.com. Whole Food Multicomplete is an entire supplement program in one bottle, containing 100% RDA of vitamins and minerals, plus live probiotics, digestive enzymes, antioxidant herbs, energy nutrients, and more. It's made in America using real foods and live probiotics. No chemical synthetics. It's soy-free, gluten-free, and independently tested and verified. They're so sure you'll love it, they're taking 20% off your first order with coupon code Scott Horton. Satisfaction is guaranteed at WholeFoodComplete.com.
All right, y'all, welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. It's my show, the Scott Horton Show. Talking about the soldiers quartered among us. You know, known as your local police department. With Shane Bauer from MotherJones.com. And, you know, Shane, they've actually skipped the armored up Humvee altogether and gone straight to the MRAP. They've got these cops, as you document here, so armored up. I was trying to daydream during the break there about what would it take for the state legislatures of America to not only stop this, but turn it around and make it, you know, less worse like it used to be back before it got all so militarized. This is so far beyond what they could even need for all the drug raids in America that they could possibly try to justify it with. I mean, it's such overkill. It's like they're preparing for a war against us all, which I think we already agreed. Nah, they're just government bureaucrats spending money and doing good for themselves and whatever. I don't see a big plot behind it or whatever it's other than political corruption, you know. But they're so armed up. What would it take? I mean, it would take I Dream a Genie to make this go away somehow. Or am I wrong?
Yeah, I don't know.
How far gone are we?
I don't know if I have the answer to that.
I mean, I don't have a genie, so I guess I'm wondering, I guess I wonder whether you think that, like, yeah, no, how far down are the slippery slope are we, I guess, is what I'm trying to ask you, clumsily.
Yeah, yeah. Well, I think, you know, one indicator is just kind of if you look at, you know, the kind of trajectory of SWAT teams, it was like started in the 70s for kind of, you know, these kind of high-risk scenarios like active shooters or hostage situations, and now most SWAT raids are for drugs, you know, drug raids. Most of them, 71% target people of color, even though these kind of, you know, situations where you have the active shooters, the hostage scenarios, the majority of those situations are involving white people. So, you know, you have people, this kind of disproportionate targeting. And, you know, it's there were situations that I talked to, for example, the University of California SWAT team. I asked them, what do they do? You know, they were doing this kind of scenario, they were, you know, training for this terrorist situation. But what they do most of the time, the guy told me, is respond to muggings of students. And this is, you know, this is kind of, to me, seems like a normal police work. You know, someone gets mugged, you go, if you know who it is, you go to the house and deal with it. But now we have these kind of police that look like soldiers that are dealing with this kind of stuff, you know, coming up in the this kind of APC looking vehicle. Actually, the guy that was selling that vehicle told me some situations you might use that for. He said, you know, use it for high risk situations. And some examples he gave me was responding to a suicide threat. You know, imagine you're suicidal, you call the police, or somebody calls the police saying you're suicidal, and these guys, SWAT team, bust in the door, you know.
Right, I got one of those right in front of me right now, in fact. Will Grigg on Lou Rockwell's blog. This happened to a guy just the other day in Roy, Utah. The guy called the suicide prevention hotline, and they sent the SWAT team, and the SWAT team killed him. And here's the quote from the cops. At some point, those negotiations failed, and unfortunately, the SWAT team was involved in a shooting, and the subject is now deceased. They killed him. The guy that called the suicide prevention hotline, Shane. Sorry, but, you know, you said it, and I got it right here from this week in the news.
Yeah.
It's absolutely out of control. So,
yeah,
now, all right, so let me give you a chance to talk about all the practice. There's some pretty outrageous stuff in your reporting here at Mother Jones about what they imagine their role could be soon, if they're lucky, I guess.
Yeah, there's, you know, so the part of this convention was a 48-hour exercise where 35 SWAT teams are going for 48 hours straight. I mean, straight, they're barely sleeping. And they're going around the San Francisco Bay Area to these different scenarios. You know, there's kind of active shooter-type situations, vehicle takedowns. There was one scenario that was a militant atheist group that was taking over a church. There was one in the bay on a boat where the scenario was that there was an earthquake and a terrorist group had taken over this boat in the wake of an earthquake. There was one that I watched was this kind of. The scenario was that a Muslim man had kind of taken a Jewish man hostage and you know, he had a bucket of chemicals that he was about to use, and they kind of had to bust in and disarm him. You know, so there were these kind of really, really high-stakes scenarios. And, you know, what was interesting to me about it was, you know, to me, it's like if I was in one of those situations, yeah, I would want somebody to get me out, obviously. But when I would ask these guys what they're doing, you know, it's this kind of drug raids, responding to muggings mostly. And then, you know, something else that was interesting was that one of the teams competing with the police was the U.S. Marines. And I talked to them after one of their exercises and asked, you know, why are the Marines kind of competing with police? And they said, you know, we learn a lot from the police. We go to these things, we learn tactics, and we bring them back to the military. And the spokesperson for Urban Shield was saying, you know, instead of talking about the militarization of the police, you should be talking about the policization of the military. He was like, you know, the military is learning a lot from us. They're taking things back to the military, in the other direction.
That's funny. Yeah. 'Cause you know, Michael Hastings reported that the military hated being cops doing counterinsurgency theory under Petraeus. It was completely ridiculous. They're supposed to stand around like Officer Smalley from the neighborhood when they're not, while Delta Force is killing people all night long in their night raids and terrorizing the crap out of the entire population. Whole thing is a farce. But yeah, as far as the Marines and the Army and their counterinsurgency doctrine going back and forth with the cops, we've seen that. We saw in 2007 in Iraq where the Marines said to the LAPD, remember how we taught you counterinsurgency for dealing with the gang problem in the 1980s? Well, we need you to teach it back to us because we kind of forgot how to do it. And so the LAPD gave the Marines training outright and sent them back to Iraq. So, yep, that's us. We're the Iraqis. We're all Iraqis now. The world's a battlefield, and it's us and them, the state, the U.S. state, and everybody else, it looks like to me, I think. Crazy.
Yeah, and we, you know, ultimately, me and my colleague who was filming, we got kicked out. You know, we were there for 3 days, and one day we were at a scenario near the Bay Bridge and kind of wanted to go along, and they, you know, told us we couldn't film, so we thought, okay, we'll go to the next one. They said we could go, but not film, so it wasn't worth it to us. And we interviewed a drone vendor before that who was there. All these exercises had different kind of companies that were selling their stuff right there at the exercise. And after the interview, the guy kind of said, I don't know about you guys. I don't get a good feeling from you. And we left. And right after we left, this police officer came out and asked us for our media badges and, you know, said that we he got an order from his commander who called him and said, you know, these guys were filming in an unauthorized location and take it. And, you know, we never got an understanding of what I still have no idea what we were allegedly filming. But,
well,
you know,
they can, draw a free speech zone. They can draw a free press zone wherever they want, I guess, Shane. We'll have to leave it there. Thanks very much. Great work here.
All right. Thank you.
All right. That's Shane Bauer, everybody. He's at Mother Jones Magazine. He's got quite a few here about the SWAT teams, but also here the making of the warrior cop, motherjones.com. Hey, all, Scott Horton here. It's always safe to say that one should keep at least some of your savings in precious metals as a hedge against inflation. And if this economy ever does heat back up and the banks start expanding credit, rising prices could make metals a very profitable bet. Since 1977, Roberts & Roberts Brokerage, Inc. has been helping people buy and sell gold, silver, platinum, and palladium, and they do it well. They're fast, reliable, and trusted for more than 35 years. And they take Bitcoin. Call Roberts & Roberts at 1-800-874-9760 or stop by rrbi.co. All right, y'all. Welcome back to the show. I'm Scott Horton. Tomorrow on the show, Peter Hart will be here to talk about the heroic Gary Webb and the continued media assassination of him and his work. And Robert A. Pape will be back on the show to talk about the true causes of suicide terrorism. So that should be a lot of fun. Oh, and then I think it's Friday we'll have John Whitehead from the Rutherford Institute to talk about some judicial tyranny that you'll be very interested in. Now we go again to Patrick Coburn from the London Independent. That's independent.co.uk, and they reprint all his stuff at uns.com. That's UNZ, uns.com. And he's the author of, and I did not think to have it right in front of me, he's the author of the book about the Islamic State and its rise, which is over there somewhere in the pile. I'm sorry. Patrick, welcome back to the show. What's the exact title of your book again? The Jihadi?
It's called The Jihadi's Return, ISIS Jihadi's and Return. The New Sunni Uprising.
I'm so sorry about that. I screwed up. The Jihadi's Return, and everybody, you can find it at orbooks.com. It won't be on Amazon until January, I believe, but it is on orbooks.com. And Patrick, I, in fact, sorry for the clumsy intro there, but the last time we spoke, that night I sat down and read the whole thing, and I've been telling everybody all about it, and that they could get it read in one sitting, too, if they would just go and get The Jihadi War. It's a very important book, and to help support your great work, of course. That's again, orbooks.com, and, really great work. Now, the latest article I have from you here, Patrick, is, ISIS in Kobani. U.S. resupplies Kurdish fighters by plane. And so, and then Turkey allows reinforcements through the border. That's another whole part of the article there. So you're catching us up on the war for, Kobani. Did I just say it wrong? The war for Kobani right there on Syria's border with Turkey. The Kurds are, as far as I know, still holding out against the attacking Islamic State. And as you say, the U.S. is now more involved than before. Can you get us updated here?
Yeah, I mean, this is a big moment in the war in Syria and a big moment for the U.S. and the Middle East. I think what happened was that the Islamic State, ISIS, had been attacking Kobani, which is this Syrian Kurdish enclave that had about 500,000 people in it on the border with Turkey. The Kurds have been fighting very heroically to defend themselves, but the Islamic State was winning. And eventually, the Washington and the White House decided that they just couldn't afford the humiliation of another Islamic State victory. The Islamic State in the last 4 months has beaten the Iraqi army, the Syrian rebels, the Iraqi Kurds. And after what Obama had said about degrading and destroying the Islamic State, I think it would have been just too damaging for them to capture Kobani despite U.S. airstrikes. That's why they switched policy, decided to drop weapons, ammunition, food, and decided to twist the Turks' arm to get them to allow Iraqi Kurdish fighters to reinforce Kobani.
Mm-hmm. All right, now let's get back to the Peshmerga part here in just a second. As far as the delay, what was behind the delay? Other than obviously the difficulty of hitting moving targets and stuff, they needed laser pointers on the ground and that kind of thing, but they do have drones, and it seemed like the Americans had sort of adopted the Turkish policy of let's sit back and watch ISIS fight the PKK for a while, who cares, rather than run into the, or I know it's the a different acronym, the YPG, I guess it is in Syria, but a break off of the Kurdistan Workers Party, right? So is that what was behind the delay there before they finally, I understand it was the humiliation of another ISIS victory that finally, especially with Panetta talking bad about Obama, politically they had to step it up. But why not step it up in the first place? They already started bombing in Syria and hitting ISIS targets back weeks ago.
Well, you know, the U.S. has this coalition, meant to be 60 countries, but the most important part of it is Saudi Arabia and the Gulf monarchies and Turkey. But it's kind of a weird coalition, because most of these countries don't really want to fight the Islamic State because they were involved in originally creating the jihadi movement that set up the Islamic State, and particularly Turkey. Turkey, you know, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has said several times that he considers the defenders of Kobani, and you're quite right, they're called the YPG, as being exactly just as much terrorists as the ISIS, as the Islamic State. In practice, actually, he seems to prefer the Islamic State to the Kurds. Now, the reason for this is that Turkey, the Turkish government, has been battling its own Kurds, about 15 million of them, for the last 30 years. They've been fighting a very effective guerrilla organization called the PKK, the Kurdistan Workers' Party, and which also controls these cantons. There are about 2.5 million Syrian Kurds in cantons, they call them, some enclaves just south of the border. What Turkey didn't want to see was suddenly quasi-independent Kurdish states being set up in Syria that would affect the Kurdish population in Turkey. I think that's why they wanted to see the Kurds go down at Kobani, why they wanted to see the Islamic State win. Of course, they never put it quite like that.
Mm-hmm. But then, so what's the American incentive for going along with that instead of loudly denouncing it and going ahead and bombing on the Syrian side of the border anyway, with or without the Turks allowing the Peshmerga to cross to help, et cetera? Because they can still put special forces on the ground. They can still drop laser designators to the YPG,
right? Yeah, I think
right?
Turkey's, you know, got a big army, 600,000 men. You know, they were allied to Turkey. I think that they didn't want to have a confrontation with the Turks, but I think eventually their patience ran out for the reason that we were just talking about. Mm-hmm. They couldn't afford, and after all, you've got your congressional elections coming up shortly. And with Obama being accused of weakness, you know, Kobani going down a few days before the election obviously wasn't going to play too well.
And now,
so that's why I think it was such a desperate effort. Before that, Kerry and people were trying to play down the significance of Kobani being captured by the Islamic State, but it obviously just wasn't going to work.
Mm-hmm. Well, now, without the American airstrikes, is it a matter of fact that ISIS would be able to take Kobani? Because it seems like those Kurdish fighters, they have their backs to the wall being the Turkish border. You know, they have everything to lose, unlike, say, the Iraqi army that fled for Mosul back in June, something like that. And they seem like, you know, the terror of the suicide attacks of ISIS don't seem to impress them nearly as much.
Yeah,
you know,
I mean,
they stand and fight
very,
anyway.
these are very committed people. You know, they're Kurdish nationalists. They belong to this very tightly organized party. They're the one people who can sort of match the Islamic State fighters in terms of fanaticism and fighting to the last bullet. So I think that, but you know, they also, you know, you need weapons, you need ammunition. I think they're running low on ammunition. ISIS captured a lot of tanks and artillery in Mosul from the Iraqi army and from the Syrian army. And the Kurds didn't have anti-tank weapons or heavier weapons. So I think that that mattered a lot to them. I think they might easily have lost without those.
Mm. All right. Well, you know what? Sorry, live audience. I'm going to go ahead and keep recording Patrick through the commercial break here. And you guys will come back into the middle of it. But there's too much to talk about here to stop for 4 minutes. Besides, just rude, you know? But we'll be right back for you. And now, Patrick, so you're talking about the Americans really twisted Erdogan's arm finally and said, let the Peshmerga from Iraq, which that's not the Kurdistan Workers Party, right? That's Barzani's guys, are going to come to the rescue. Is that it?
Yeah, that's right, because that's the Turkey gets on a bit better with them, gets on fine with them, in fact, compared to the Syrian Kurds. So it's a bit less humiliating for them to have the Iraqi Kurds cross their territory. But I think that they had their arms twisted seriously to do that, because previously, as you said, they'd sealed the border, they weren't allowing arms and ammunition across. So effectively, they were assisting the Islamic State. I think that they may have seen that they were sort of, Turkey was increasingly being regarded as a sort of secret ally of ISIS, of the Islamic State, and that wasn't going to do Turkey any good in the long term.
All right, well, so now, but have they permanently alienated and ended their, alienated the PKK and ended their kind of truce that they've had going on with the PKK for the last few years? And by the way, how much influence does the PKK have and the Kurdistan Workers Party have inside Turkish Kurdistan? I mean, they rule all, like they're the Barzani and Talibani of Turkey?
No, they don't. But I mean, they win elections, but the Turkish government tends to annul them, you know.
Yeah.
But there's no doubt they have massive popular support there. They're not the only Kurdish party, mm-hmm. but they've been fighting since 1984. They have a truce at the moment. And Kurds generally feel that they haven't got much out of this ceasefire arrangement. Of course, the prestige of the PKK has shot up because of being able to fight the Islamic State, mm-hmm. unlike the Iraqi Kurds, who got beaten pretty fast. So far, at the moment, the thing to bear in mind is that the Syrian Kurds are the first group of people who've actually been able to fight the Islamic State and come out ahead. So, again, it was sort of ridiculous for the U.S. to keep on saying we need partners on the ground. And then when you have a real partner on the ground, you ignore them and, in fact, set them up to being defeated. So I don't think that this sort of contradiction became too blatant, mm-hmm. Which is why they started dropping arms to them and supporting them with airstrikes.
Yeah.
Of course, there's another reason for the airstrikes. So most of the time, you can't find the Islamic State. Most of these, there have been about 969, I think, missions to mostly by U.S. aircraft in Iraq and Syria in the 2 months after the first attacks started on August the 8th. But only 10% of those actually involved attacks. The rest of the aircraft came back because they couldn't find anything, any targets. Now, it's an enormous advantage when you have the Islamic State concentrating its forces at Kobani that you can bomb them, and you also have somebody watching them on the ground. You know, the stuff about drones is a bit exaggerated. It's a bit, we suffer from a lot of the same advantages of looking anything out of from an aircraft that there's a good chance you won't see it if it's camouflaged. Mm. But people from the ground can see things. So, again, it was an ideal circumstances in which to use airstrikes.
Mm-hmm. And now, It's interesting that it was just yesterday I interviewed your brother Andrew about the war inside the Air Force over the A-10 and how they're bombing with these B-2s that can't possibly hit, basically, when they've done as much as they can to marginalize the A-10 that could actually be useful in circumstances like this. People can hear that interview, of course, at scotthorton.org. But then, so I guess it brings up the question of who is doing the pointing with the laser designators there. Is it the YPG, or do we have JSOC special forces on the ground there directing the airstrikes?
I don't know the answer. You know, probably the U.S. wants to sort of blur the situation, you know. How would you do that? Maybe you'd put somebody under contract who was, you know, you don't need that many people, but you do need a few. They sort of hint and say they're sort of indirectly in touch with the Kurds. But I mean, I don't think it really matters much. I mean, the truth is that they're getting very precise information as to where the Islamic State fighters are and, you know, which buildings and, which hilltops, and they're using it. So they've ended up in cooperating with people who, they've designated, they've labeled previously as terrorists.
Right. Well, then, is this proof of concept about this, for the... I'm sorry, go ahead.
That's the absurd thing about this coalition, is that it included all the people who, like Saudi Arabia and the others, who didn't really want to fight the Islamic State, and excluded those who were fighting the Islamic State, like the Syrian Kurds, like the Syrian army, like the Iraqi militia in Iraq, Shia militia. This was never going to work.
Right.
And the same contradiction will come up. What will happen if the Islamic State attacks the Syrian army? Is the U.S. going to just let them win another victory? You know, when push comes to shove, I think they'll do exactly the same thing again. They'll establish links with the Syrian army so they can get equipment or somehow identify where the Islamic State is and then use their air power. So I think that the policy that Burma originally devised is sort of coming apart.
Yeah. So in other words, though, it sounds like what you're saying is the kind of serving as air power for local militias on the ground who actually have a reason and a will to fight the Islamic State could work. All morality aside, or even bigger strategy aside, but just tactically speaking, it sounds like you're saying that, well, like in this case with these Kurds, it can work to fight the Islamic State. It's just that Obama's allied himself with all the wrong characters in the region in order to get that done.
Yeah, that's basically the situation. I mean, you've got to be, you know, there's a civil war in Syria, there's a civil war in Iraq, and the U.S. has kind of plugged itself into those civil wars. You know, let's say you support the Iraqi Shia militias against the Islamic State. But these guys are very sectarian. You know, they enter Sunni areas. You know, they murder the men, they rape the women, you know, they throw everybody else in jail. That it's probably reasonable enough to defend Kobani or other areas, but you don't want to be sucked into being a sort of patsy for one of these sectarian militias, which will, you know, it's not going to advance. A Shia militia isn't going to advance into a Sunni village and everybody's going to cheer. You know, everybody's going to either fight or run. Most of them will run.
Right. So in other words, we can help, again, utilitarian speaking, morality aside, interventionism as a principle aside, we could help the Kurds, the Shia, hold the line on their own territory. But if we help them, you know, to attempt to dislodge the Islamic State from the predominantly Sunni areas, that's just going to blow up right in our face because of the sectarianism and because of the bloody record of these killer militias.
That they're not going to use American airstrikes, you know, to establish concord with their Sunni neighbors. They're going to use them to either drive them out or kill them.
Right.
And the Sunni know that. You know, in these areas, the Islamic State rules. I know people in Mosul, you know, really hate them and, you know, lost their jobs and everything else. But they're also terrified of the Iraqi government and the Shia militias. And, you know, at least with the Islamic State, with their Sunni, they're probably still alive. the Iraqi government or the Shia militias come in, they might very soon be dead.
Mm. All right. Now, so I have a theory, and this is principle first and conclusion later, maybe. But I believe, Patrick, that the utilitarian answer for how best to destroy the Islamic State is the same as my principled one, and that's for the United States to do absolutely nothing, because the Islamic State is surrounded by enemies, and they really have no capability of establishing a real state, and they got the worst part of Iraq to rule as far as the natural oil wealth. They have no trading partners. Everyone around hates them, and anything we could do, like you're talking about, is going to, you know, to advance against them, help others advance against them, is going to backfire in a negative way, and we can see that going in. And so, but on the other hand, if we do nothing, since they're landlocked, and since none of their enemies that surround them really have the wherewithal to attack without American air cover, for example, then it would just be up to the local Sunnis that they're trying to foist their totalitarian rule on. And then those people, as we've seen before back in 2006 and 7, as you covered at the time, are perfectly happy to turn right around and shoot Al-Qaeda in Iraq right in the head for attempting to rule them, when their typical traditional system is a tribal system, and they rather listen to their local imams rather than a bunch of lunatic suicide bomber types. So do you think that maybe if we really just do nothing, it'd be best?
I think you could do it now, because these guys are very well organized, they're very tough, and they'll kill anybody, you know, who they think is going to resist them. I think what ought to be done is, you know, ISIS, you know, has, you know, that kind of Islamic Khmer Rouge, you know, they combine fanaticism with military expertise. I think what you've got to do is sort of de-escalate the war in Syria. You want to get Assad, and you want to get the opponents of Assad, apart from the Islamic State, and get them to agree a truce.
Including al-Nusra?
No, probably. No, not, because, I mean, that's just one more jihadi movement. You know, it's the affiliate of al-Qaeda. You know, it's also very murderous against it. You know, people say it's better than the Islamic State. That's not saying a lot. You know, it's still, if you're a non-Sunni Muslim and they come into town, they're very likely to chop your head off, you know.
Well, and these two groups together are the Syrian rebellion, though, right? I mean, what's left after that?
Well, there are, you know, there are some others, but I think that they dominated. But I think that you need to be offering the Sunni population peace. You know, you've got to try and demilitarize the situation.
I see. Rather than backing a new rebel
army. The U.S. policy, you know, is to raise a group of moderates. And these moderates are going to fight the Islamic State and the Syrian army at the same time. You know, this is a great way of ending up dead. But it's sort of, and it's a pretty stupid policy. But, you know, they have to really decide who they're going to back in Syria. Otherwise, what they're doing is a recipe for continuous war. And I think they were fairly cynical about this, because they didn't realize that this continuous war was going to produce an organization like ISIS, like the Islamic State. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, and domestic politics just absolutely preclude working with Assad. Or I don't know, maybe they really have turned back toward him. I guess as you reported before.
I think that they have covertly, you know, they obviously do have a relationship, you know, while denying it the whole time, but they obviously do, and they'd have it through other intelligence services. You know, it's quite easy to do this. You go to somebody else, you tell something to some other intelligence service, you tell it to the Syrian army, you know. Sure. So it's, that's quite easily done. I'm sure they're doing that. But what they need to, all these groups in Syria and Iraq, and certainly in Syria and to a degree in Iraq, depend on, outside, backers for money and support. You would need to go to the outside backers, the Russians, the Iranians, the Saudis. And at that level, you can fix something else up to have a truce. The ceasefire, people hate each other too much to agree to any solutions at this stage, but maybe you could have a truce.
Mm, yeah. And now, so what about the eastern frontier of the Islamic State at this point? I've seen quite a bit of debate about whether ISIS could take, well, it doesn't seem like too many serious people think they could just invade Baghdad, but some say that they could lay siege to it. They could completely surround it and cut it off from the other southern cities, that Najaf and Karbala and the other, and Basra even, the predominantly Shiite south, that they are at risk to the Islamic State. Can you judge the relative power of what's left of the Iraqi army and the Shiite militias and their ability to hold that territory compared to the power and the armament of the Islamic State to try to take it? Do you think they'll even try to take it?
I think, and this would have to be the last question because I have to go, but
sure.
I think that they could invade Baghdad. Baghdad is a city of 7 million people. The majority are Shia, but there are big Sunni enclaves. And in this month, in the Islamic State has taken most of Anbar province to the west. This is an enormous area. And I think they may want to invade Baghdad. I mean, I don't think they could take the whole of it, but I think they could take Sunni areas. I think they could start a panic. The Iraqi army was pretty bad, you know, when it lost Mosul 4 months ago. It's still pretty bad. You know, it's managed to lose everything since. It hasn't been able to put in a single decent counterattack. You know, its troops complain that they don't get ammunition, weapons, food, or even get their pay. So I think things are still pretty bad. And I think that ISIS might attack Baghdad and take over these enclaves, Sunni enclaves. But why would they do it? Well, I think it would sort of, they want to sort of assert themselves as a state, taking part of Baghdad, where the caliphate, the caliph used to rule, would be one way of doing that. That would mean that all the Sunni population was under their rule. Was there a million or two Sunni in Baghdad? So I think that that could easily happen. They could also, as you said, they could cut it off, maybe not every road, but most roads to the north and the south. But of course, the Shia militias are driving out Sunni from these areas, so it's a war that's getting worse. We've still got a long way to go.
All right. Well, thanks very much for your time again, Patrick. I sure appreciate it.
Sure thing. Thank you. Bye-bye.
All right, y'all. That's the great Patrick Coburn. The book is The Jihadi's Return, ISIS and the New Sunni Uprising. It's really great. You can sit down and read it one sitting. It's at orbooks.com. He writes, of course, at The Independent. That's independent.co.uk. The latest is ISIS in Kobani, U.S. resupplies Kurdish fighters by plane. And there's a brand new one coming out, I happen to know. Just keep your eye on The Independent on uns.com and on antiwar.com for that. All right, and that's it for the show. Thanks, everybody, for listening. Overtime. See you back here again tomorrow.